The environmental and social effects of the industrial capitalist system have long been obvious to marginalized communities forced to live in the garbage dumps of production while their resources are pillaged for raw materials. However, today, the systemic effects are increasingly visible to all. It's clear. To save humanity and complex life on our precious planet, we need a major course change. If we're to survive, we need to figure out how to leave fossil fuels in the ground and how to adapt to the already changing climate while moving towards renewable energies, sustainable levels of energy use, and other social transformations. Billions will be spent on trying to adapt, finding new water sources, restructuring agriculture, and changing the crops that are grown, building seawalls, changing the shape and style of cities, and on trying to shift to green sources of energy by building the required infrastructure, investing in green jobs and technology. But whose interest will this adaptation and energy transition serve? And who will be expected to bear the heaviest costs of this climate crisis and of the responses to it? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. Since the 1990s, the ultra-globalization and food sovereignty movements have advanced large-scale critiques of neoliberal capitalism. In the 21st century, a wide variety of movements have adopted a shared language of system change, arguing that human rights abuses, political and social harms, and the climate crisis can be addressed only by a transformation of our entire social, cultural, political, and economic system. However, whatever transition happens must not come at the price of the destruction of lives and livelihood. Justice has to be a key factor. The movements often use an intersectional lens, arguing that sexism and patriarchy, racism, and other forms of violence and systems of oppression are fundamental features of the capitalist system and must be addressed. Increasingly, these different calls are beginning to come together under the banner of just transition. But what do we mean by a just transition? And how do we orient ourselves towards such a transition? On today's episode of the State of Power podcast, Hamza Hamushin unpacks a vision for a just transition with a specific focus on North Africa. Hamza has done research on extractivism, energy democracy, food sovereignty, and environmental and climate justice in the North African context. He's also the coordinator for North Africa at the Transnational Institute, where he's recently put together a dossier, a collection of essays from multiple authors, focusing on different dimensions of the energy transition in North Africa. With this year's United Nations Conference of the Parties, COP27, taking place in Egypt, there seems to be no better time to put a spotlight on the region. I began by asking Hamza to explain the motivation behind the dossier.
Thanks, Sean, for giving me the opportunity to talk about this dossier. I see the dossier as one attempt to remedy a gap in radical and critical scholarship around questions of climate change, the ecological crisis, and specifically the energy transition in North Africa and the Arab region more broadly. We know that most of the writing on these issues is dominated by international neoliberal institutions such as the World Bank, EU agencies, and other international cooperation and development agencies such as the German GIZ. Their analysis is biased and is aligned to those who have power and who have wealth. And it doesn't take into account questions of class, race, gender, power, and colonial legacy. And the solutions they propose or the prescriptions they advance are market-based, consolidate private interests and privatizations. They are top-down and do not really address the root causes of the climate, ecological, and food and energy crisis. So in reality, the knowledge they produce is profoundly disempowering because it overlooks questions of oppression and resistance. And usually they focus on the so-called experts to the exclusions of voices and resistance from below. So this is a collection of essays from various North African countries focusing on dimensions of the energy transition and how to make this process equitable and just. To my knowledge, and until now, there is no widely available collection of writings by critical North African researchers or activists on a just energy transition, either in Arabic or in English or in French, or as a book or an online resources. We've seen in the last 2 to 3 years, the publication of important books on various Green New Deals and the needed energy transition in various concepts. And these books are gaining increased attention, but writings by critical authors from the Global South remain marginal, in my view, including in North Africa and the Arab region in general. So the objective for me working on that dossier, actually for more than 2 years, trying to get analysis and writings from various authors and activists from the region. And the idea is to expand this. So now the focus is just North Africa, but we want to expand it to include other countries from the Middle East, from the Gulf countries, Iraq, Palestine. But overall, the main objectives are to increase the structural critique in green transition debates by centering the voices of activists and scholars from the North African and Arab region. We would like to highlight the urgency of climate crisis in the region and push back against the entrenchment of extractivism, energy colonialism, and trying to emphasize the need for a structural analysis and change. And we would like also to counteract the dominant neoliberal and neocolonial discourse on the green transition that is being currently promoted by various international actors in the region. And finally, we would like to support the progressive forces, movements, and grassroots in North Africa and the Arab region to articulate a localized, democratic, and public response to the urgently needed energy transition. And this is even more important given that the next climate talks or negotiations, COP27 and COP28, are taking place in the Arab region. So this is overall why we are doing this collection or dossier.
Great, Hamza. Thanks. So it seems there was indeed really a gap that you're managing to fill with putting together this collection of thinkers who are sort of saying, okay, let's move away from the Eurocentric and I guess North American centered perspective and give something that comes really from the people who are, I think, also the most affected by this, right? By this question. You say in the intro to the dossier that we need to start looking at the issue of climate change through a justice lens rather than a security one. Can you deepen that for me? Can you clarify exactly what does that mean?
Yeah, actually, this goes to the heart of the matter, the question of justice, because that dossier adopts an explicit justice lens, and it aims to expose, you know, the policies and practices that protect global political elites, multinational corporations, and authoritarian and military regimes in the region. So we would like to overcome that security discourse. So the dossier avoids making demands framed around security, like climate security, energy security, food security. And it promotes, as I said, notions of justice, sovereignty, and decoloniality. Because more often when we talk about climate security, when governments or powerful governments talk about climate security, the first idea that comes to their mind is, how do we keep climate refugees away? Mm-hmm. How do we keep the excluded, the marginalized, the surplus humanity at bay?
Yeah, it's really about whose security, right?
Exactly.
Like, security requires there's someone who's being secure, and secure from who and what.
Exactly. And the future that is subjugated to security, like forces our struggles into a kind of a conceptual and imaginative framework that ultimately re-empowers the state's repressive power in the service of certain classes and certain elites, and ends up securitizing and militarizing the climate response. And I strongly believe that more tanks and more guns, higher walls and more militarized borders will not solve the climate crisis. At best, what they're gonna do is protect the rich, allow them to survive in comfort while the rest of the world pays the price for climate inaction. So it's better to center our demands, or to center our response, on questions of justice and sovereignty, and looking at what the majority of people are facing.
Yeah, so the title is Just Transition in North Africa, right? I think this is a broader framework that I think maybe bears a little bit of explanation. What is the Just Transition framework that inspires your analysis? Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, of course. So the original concept of just transition was rooted in building alliances between workers in polluting industries and frontline communities facing environmental degradation. Mm-hmm. And actually, this concept has a history, like from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it gained some popularity as a powerful framework that can unite different forms of resistance and struggle against, you know, the global political and economic model, the system we live under, that is destroying the planet, concentrating wealth, and increasingly exploiting workers around the world, as well as externalizing socio-ecological costs to marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. So we know that the current economic system is undermining, you know, the life support systems of the planet, and will eventually collapse. To borrow the words of an organization called Movement Generation, transition has become inevitable, but mm-hmm. justice is not. Mm-hmm. So in this context, at least the way I see it, just transition is a framework for a fair shift to an economy that is ecologically sustainable, equitable, and just for all its members. Mm-hmm. So it means a kind of a transition from an economic system that has been built based on the excessive extraction, or what we call extractivism of resources, mm-hmm. and the intensive exploitation of people, to a different system that is structured instead around the restoration, regeneration of territories, land, people's rights and dignity. And of course, those concepts have different meaning depending on who uses them, and mm-hmm. they can be captured. But for me, a robust and radical vision of just transition needs to see environmental destruction, capitalist extraction, imperialist violence, the global disparities and inequalities, the exploitation we are continuing to see, and marginalization as simultaneous effects of one global system, which is the capitalist imperialist system, that need to be radically transformed. And of course, this needs to take into account questions of class, race, gender, power, colonial history. Basically, if we try to address one aspect of all this, you know, like multi-form or multifaceted crisis, such as, let's say, the environmental catastrophe, in isolation from, you know, the social, political, and economic structure that gave rise to it in the first place, those solutions will inevitably remain false solutions. And I think we need to be sensitive to the fact that we have massive global and historical inequalities still continuing to the present. And these are part of the things that need to be transformed. So just transition would look different in different places. And in fact, I prefer to use the term in plural, just transitions, because sometimes what might work in Europe must not necessarily be appropriate in Africa. And what might work in Egypt, for example, might not work in South Africa. And what might work in urban areas in Morocco, for example, might not be good for rural areas there. So we need to be imaginative and have a decentralized approach with guidance from workers and local populations themselves. And I think I'll finish by this. For me, just transitions are not just about energy. It's about, you know, radically transforming the economic structures, doing agriculture in a different way, away from the intensive, capitalist, exhausting industrial agriculture and farming we are doing now. We need to move towards agroecology. So these are all elements of that framework. Of course, it is not comprehensive and exhaustive, but I feel these are one of the main tenets of a just transition.
Great. Yeah, so this is moving away from just like saying we want change. It's about the nature of the change that we want to see, and how it makes sure that people are not left on the wayside, essentially, as society transitions, as you put it. So who are the working people who should be at the forefront of this just transition?
I think that's a very good question. And I think this is related to what I said earlier about, you know, the discourse, the narrative, and the solution proposed by the powerful of this world, including, you know, international financial institutions, because they exclude people. They don't want to hear from people. Their approach is top-bottom approach.
They already know what needs to be done, and everyone just has to sort of toe the line.
And of course, and their solutions have a class content, right? So they end up entrenching power, they end up reinforcing the private sector, and, you know, re-empowering multinational corporations and that benefit from those crises themselves. So the concept of just transition put working people at the heart of that project. The working people constitute the majority of people living in the planet. For me, the way I see working people is an attempt to go beyond, let's say, the conventional and orthodox way of looking at workers and working classes, because there is a tendency just to focus on urban, organized, industrial workers, and exclude other fractions of working people. Like, if we go to the African context in general, most of the workers are informal workers. So they're not organized industrial workers. So in North Africa, for example, up to 60% of the workers are informal. In other African countries, that percentage reaches 80, 90% of the population works in the informal economy. So how do we integrate those different fractions into working people? And the idea is not just analytical or abstract or theoretical, but strategic. How do we build strategic alliances between different fractions of people from different contexts and different backgrounds in order to create convergences of struggles that would challenge the predatory operation of capital in order to bring a better world, in order to bring radical and meaningful change. So, and that working people, the concept has been inspired by the political work and the political theorization of Walter Rodney, the Guyanese revolutionary thinker and activist, and has been articulated by another Tanzanian Marxist called Issa Shivji, trying to use that concept to bring different fractions of working people together. And that includes, as I said, informal workers, that include the unemployed people. Like just to give you a percentage, in the Arab region, the youth unemployment rate is double the global average. So Where do we put those unemployed? Do they remain just in the excluded category? No, because those unemployed take action. The unemployed people take action, organize themselves, do resistance. And I've documented a lot of unemployed movements in the context of North Africa. And also the small-scale farmers, the fisher folk, the pastoralists, unpaid and underpaid labor, mostly done by women in terms of care, domestic work, and reproduction, migrant workers. So we need to bring all these people together along the urban and rural continuum. There is a spectrum of workers that go from urban to rural. And in order to challenge, we need to challenge this urban, rural dichotomy or polarization, and bring people together in order to to challenge the economic system that is super exploiting all of these fractions of society, and even pushes them to self-exploit by giving up some part of their essential daily consumption. So that is globally the idea. And in terms of just transition, we need to identify who are the working people, who are the fractions of working people that are key in that struggle. How do we build alliances? How do we build bridges beyond borders, beyond rural-urban dichotomy, beyond different contexts? Because, the struggle is global, it's not just local.
It's manifesting in different ways, in different places, but we are all pretty much facing the same monster. And speaking of which, you mentioned that there's no blanket definition for just transition, right? It's just transitions, as you say. So it looks different wherever you're looking at it from. This dossier is about just transition in North Africa. So what's unique about the region? Can you say more about what a just response to climate change would look like in North Africa?
Yeah, excellent question. As you said, just transition would look different in different places. North Africa, of course, has its own specificities and unique features. And even within North Africa or the Arab region, there are differences between different countries. But there are main features that we can talk about. So if we focus on North Africa, the North African region has been forcibly integrated into the global capitalist economy in a subordinate position since colonial times. So those colonial powers, such as France and Britain and others, forced those North African countries to structure their economies around the extraction and export of resources. And these resources are usually provided cheaply and in raw form. And this is coupled with the import of high value industrial goods. And this resulted in large scale transfer of wealth to the imperial centers at the expense of local developments in the region. And this is just not unique to North Africa. We could widen the analysis to the whole African continent and other parts of the global South. Mm-hmm. And such unequal and asymmetric relations persist till today and reaffirms the role of the North African countries as exporters of natural resources, such as oil and gas, and primary commodities that are heavily dependent on water and land, such as monoculture cash crops. So we have a kind of an outward-looking extractivist economy. Just you export, even you export water-intensive monocrop agricultural commodities. You'll end up virtually exporting your own water. And this exacerbates the food dependency in the region, exacerbates also the ecological crisis while maintaining the imperialist domination and the neocolonial hierarchies. So in this context, what do we mean by a just response to the climate and ecological crisis? What is a just transition in the North African context? I feel that, first of all, and most importantly, we need to talk about the recognition of the historic responsibility of the industrialized West in causing global warming. I think we need to start from there.
Yeah.
And then the second thing for me, at least in the context of North Africa right now, is the question of democratization and the end of business as usual. Many governments in the region are authoritarian. Many nations in the region are governed by repressive and ruthless military dictatorships. How can you talk about your future while you cannot say a word or shape any decisions when it comes to politics, economics, and society? So that these questions of the end of the business, breaking with the business of usual and democratization, is very important. And the other thing, the North African region and the Arab region is an important node in the global capitalist economy, in the global capitalist fossil fuel economy. Huge reserves of oil and gas are in the underground of those countries. The Gulf countries, Iraq, Libya, Algeria. So all of these countries are still dependent on fossil fuels. So how do we move from fossil fuel-based regimes towards renewable or green energy-based regimes? And in here, you need to involve, first of all, workers in those oil industries. So trade-independent trade unions in those industries need to be involved. A serious discussion around what a just transition would mean for the oil and gas workers, because I don't believe that a just transition would take place without the workers in those industries. Of course, there will be tensions, there will be compromises, but they need to be involved in terms of retraining, finding them green jobs, and so forth. And the most important thing, how do you finance this? And in here, I believe you need some climate reparations, you need some climate debts. That finance, that climate finance that has been promised for decades through the COP process that has not materialized yet, it needs to materialize. And maybe we can go more into this in a bit. But more importantly, that transition, either in North Africa or beyond or in other regions, needs to be under public ownership. So we need huge public investments in moving away from fossil fuels, in diversifying the economy, in sustainable agriculture, in sustainable transport. And you need the involvement, as I said, of workers and communities, where maybe big projects like solar plants and wind farms will be built. They need to embrace those projects. They need to embrace that transition. And you cannot do that without, you know, radical and participatory democracy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the issue of climate reparation. So we know who's pretty much carries most of the burden and the guilt for causing the climate crisis as we see it. I remember I had a guest on the podcast before who was like, we actually have the addresses of some of these corporations that bear a huge responsibility for what's happened to the climate, and we can't pretend that everyone was equally responsible. So you mentioned now the issue of climate reparations, but my question is, what would these reparations look like, and is it really feasible? The idea of having climate reparations. This question always comes up.
Yeah, of course. The burden is always on us, like to come up with
To explain why.
prescriptions and blueprints and provide, some revolutionary outlook and how we're gonna change the world, right? But it doesn't work like this. I think there are very interesting and ongoing discussions on climate reparations and climate debts. Maybe not enough, but I've seen it taking place. So it's coming to the agenda and the table of the global climate justice movement, that question of reparations. In terms of feasibility, they tell you, where would the money come from? You know how much subsidies currently go to the fossil fuel industries? Like some scholars estimated them in the trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars. And the COP process have just been promising just $100 billion a year. So trillions of dollars still go to the fossil fuel industry, especially in the current context of the war in Ukraine, after Russia invaded Ukraine. So we are seeing more fossil fuel projects, more fossil fuel infrastructures being built, from pipelines to liquefied natural gas ports. So a lot of investments and subsidies are going to the fossil fuel industry. Why don't you shift that money, towards the energy transition, towards helping impoverished countries face the climate impacts, adapt to the climate impacts? We are already seeing those impacts in terms of losses and damages right now. But the powerful of this world, the imperial powers of this world, refuse to recognize their own historical and moral responsibility. So for me, the question is not financial and economic. Where would the money come from? Of course, it is part of it. The question is political. Is there a political will to remedy, repair, restitute, and redistribute wealth? There are many various proposals out there. Like for me, the first things that come to my mind in terms of climate reparations, why don't you cancel the debts that are already burdening a lot of countries in the global south? Though that debt burden does not allow countries to invest appropriately or adequately in tackling climate change and the impacts of climate change, and investing in their own green transitions towards renewable energy. So this can be one element. The other element for me is halt the illicit capital flows. Every year, hundreds of billions of dollars leave the African continent illicitly, illegally. This, like you are seeing a plunder of wealth and resources still ongoing. And I think this need to stop, and there are international mechanisms that would make this stop. But no, what they do is
Is
they
there a
just
will to actually implement
yeah.
that?
Because what they end up doing is just consolidating, the offshore, havens. So we are still seeing a lot of money being siphoned off from those countries and facilitated by, Western governments, by London, by Paris, by Washington. They are allowing for that illicit transfer of wealth. And then you have also those trade agreements, the neo-colonial trade and investment agreements. One of them, I think you've done a lot of podcasts around this, is the Energy Charter Treaty that allows fossil fuel companies to sue governments that dare to introduce, let's say, environmental regulations or climate targets. So how can we achieve the climate targets while allowing or giving more power to fossil fuel companies to sue governments? So this needs to stop as well. These are a few things that can be done, but in reality, it's a matter of transfer of wealth and technology. What about the monopolies, the intellectual property regimes, the cruel that showed their cruelty during the pandemic? In the current crisis, in the current global climate emergency, technology transfer needs to be one of the fundamental principles for any just energy transition. But this only can be implemented through mobilizations, through pressure from below, because if we expect that the powerful of this world to give us those things on a plate, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's really, really frustrating when you think about it, that as you pointed out just right now, the solutions are pretty much standing in front of us, and it's about having the political will to carry them through. I have to think also right now in the context of what you just mentioned, looking at climate change through a justice lens rather than a security one, how much money also goes to military solutions for climate change instead of actually really giving money to the countries that need it so that they can implement these solutions, this wide range of solutions that you just pointed out.
No, you're right, Sean, because just to add one thing, because the arguments are that where would the money come from? There is no money is mobilized and put on the table. Mm-hmm. But then you just look now at the money and the weapons that are being poured in Ukraine just to escalate the war and escalate the suffering and the misery. So the money suddenly materializes to give money to the arms industry. And then during the pandemic, we've seen how suddenly governments, including in the industrialized West, put money into tackling the pandemic, even in limited ways. But the money suddenly materializes. But now, who pays for this? It's the people through austerity programs. It doesn't need to be like this.
Yeah.
If we want justice, you can't tax the rich. You can mobilize the money and invest in those solutions if you want. It's about political will at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. So speaking of political will, right, the Conference of Parties is meeting in Egypt, as you pointed out at the beginning, it's the 27th COP. So 27 times we've been trying, maybe this is the lucky time. But what do you expect from your honest assessment of the build-up of the history of COP and what's going on this year? What do you expect from COP27?
I think what I would say, I don't think we should give false promises to people, especially young people, around this COP process. Because every year, and for almost 30 years, as you said, the world's political leaders, their advisors, media, and corporate lobbyists, including the fossil fuel lobbyists, gather in those COPs, the United Nations Climate Conference of the Parties. But despite the threat facing the planet, the governments just continue to allow carbon emissions to rise, and the crisis to escalate. And Greta Thunberg, I think, has been right in calling, in saying blah 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 blah. So that's what they've been doing for almost 30 years. And for me, at least personally, it has become evident that these climate talks are bankrupt and are failing. If they have not failed yet, they have been hijacked by corporate power and private interests that continue to profit from the crisis and promoting some false solutions like carbon trading, the so-called net zero, nature-based solutions. And instead of, forcing industrialized nations and multinationals to reduce the carbon emissions and leave fossil fuel in the ground, I've attended COP26 last year in Glasgow. It attracted, massive media attention, but for me, it achieved no major breakthroughs, especially for the Global South. And the 2022 and the 2023 climate talks that will be held in the Arab region, so the COP27 will be in Egypt, and COP28 would be in the United Arab Emirates, for me, are not expected to achieve much. Especially, first of all, they are taking place in highly authoritarian contexts. So there would be no serious engagement from civil societies, from the working people we've been talking about. And also, globally, we are seeing an intensification of geopolitical rivalries unleashed by, the war in Ukraine. And this context, I don't feel it is amenable to cooperation between major powers, and probably will provide another pretext for continuing the global addiction to fossil fuels. So I'm not very optimistic. I know that some comrades and some other activists see it as a tactical move to participate inside, to get some media attention, to pressure, and especially that those COPs, the COP27 is taking place in the African continent, the question of, you know, loss and damage and climate finance or climate reparation is on the top of the agenda. But I'm not expecting much, to be honest, Sean.
Yeah. So where do we look to for a bit of optimism, Hamza?
I think we need to look at the ongoing struggles of frontline communities, of working people who are still resisting. People are not passive victims in all this, you know, multifaceted crisis. Yeah. Maybe we can be, let's say, pessimistic intellectually, but there is a kind of, as Gramsci says, that there is an optimism of the will. In the short term, things are difficult, but people always organize, rise, resist. They challenge, you know, the despoiling of their environments, the plundering of their resources, the destructions of their livelihoods. And also they propose solutions. People organize and propose solutions from, you know, different philosophies coming from indigenous communities, from the Food Sovereignty International Movement, La Via Campesina. There are attempts to articulate alternatives around the social and solidarity economy. There are even, you know, very good ideas that I'm very sympathetic to in the global north, in Europe and North America, in terms of degrowth, because we need to change.
The solution has to come from both ends, essentially, right?
Yes, of course, of course. Yeah. And I think those articulation and convergences between all these intellectual and activist currents, you know, from degrowth, ecosocialism, Pacamama, Bienvivir, food sovereignty, you know, decoloniality, I believe that they would create a kind of global tapestry of resistance. In the midterm or long term, maybe change would happen. So I always see it that way. I remain optimistic, but then we need to diagnose the reality and see that things are really bad in the current context. And I think recognizing this and trying to build towards better alternatives, towards public ownership of resources, of energy, food systems, of land and other resources is very, very, very important.
I think this really sums it up well. There's still some hope.
Yeah, there is still some hope.
Thanks so much, Hamza. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. This was a conversation with Hamza Hamoshen, who is the coordinator for North Africa at the Transnational Institute. At TNI, we've built an entire archive of research on the just transition and other related topics. This dossier on just transition in North Africa is the latest edition, but we invite you to explore our research. See some of the links in the podcast description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today. See you next time.